Right, so we're going to be having a look at the next part of Luke, which is in Luke chapter 22, and it's verses 54 to 65 that we're going to be looking at tonight. Now, to begin with, just have a think, has there been any situation where you have really let somebody down and you felt just absolutely devastated at the fact that you let them down, you didn't mean to, you promised to do something and then you had all intentions of doing it and then ended up letting the person down. Now, a few months ago, Lisa had picked our boys up from school just as normal, took them home, just an ordinary sort of day, brought them home. They were playing, she was doing something else, and just a totally nondescript occasion. And then she received a message on her phone and just looked as the name flashes up, and it was a friend's name flashed up. And as soon as the name flashed up, Lisa had that terrible feeling that I've just described, where she realised she'd forgotten something very important, because she had agreed to pick up her friend's son from school that day. She was doing it every Wednesday for a period of time. She picked him up the week before, but had totally forgot to pick this lad up from school. The poor kid had been stood in his classroom door and seen Lisa and our boys like walking off into the distance. And as soon as Lisa saw that message, she just felt absolutely devastated. I've promised to do something. It's important. And I've let my friend down. Now, her friend was really nice about it. It was fine. But that's the sort of thing that I'm talking about. Has there been something where you've let somebody down badly? You feel terrible about it. It might be like that. They'll just describe it as accidental. You just like forgot to do what you said you were going to do. It might not have been accidental. It might be that you had to make a choice between two things and you ended up choosing something and that as a result let somebody down. It might be quite serious, that it might be that you let somebody down and now that has caused a rift in your relationship and the relationship hasn't gone back to what it was before. Or it might be that somebody's let you down and the relationship is broken down because of that. We're going to look at possibly the most famous example of that sort of thing tonight in this passage. Just to remind you where we're at in Luke, 2 years ago, whenever it was that Andy Robinson spoke to us last Sunday, he was looking at the earlier part of this chapter where Jesus is arrested. And so we've seen this scene as Jesus comes to Jerusalem and he's getting in more and more conflict with the religious leaders. They're looking for an opportunity to kill him. And Judas gives him that opportunity and agrees to betray him. And then Jesus starts teaching his disciples that he's going to die. That's what he's saying at the Last Supper. He's telling them again that he must die. They don't quite get it. He then goes out with his disciples to the Mount of Olives. And this is what we were looking at last week, where Jesus is just overwhelmed with agony at the thought of what is coming for him, that he's going to endure the punishment that all of our sin deserves. He's going to endure God's anger and God's wrath that is undeserved for him. And he just is overwhelmed with agony, it says. He's sweating like drops of blood. He's agonized over it. But he's set on the fact that that's the mission. That's the mission that God the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit had agreed to out of love. That's what they wanted to do out of love for us. And so he sets his face to continue with that mission. But it just shows how difficult it is. And then as he gets up from that, Judas arrives with some soldiers and Judas betrays Jesus. And the soldiers arrest him and take him off. And so we're going to pick that up in Luke chapter 22. And I'll start reading it, verse 54. Then seizing him, that's Jesus, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. Peter followed at a distance. And when some there had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, "This man was with him." But he denied it. "Woman, I don't know him," he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, "You also are one of them." "Man, I am not," Peter replied. About an hour later, another asserted, "Certainly this fellow was with him, for he's a Galilean." Peter replied, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." Just as he was speaking, the cock crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word that the Lord had spoken to him. "Before the cock crows today, you will disown me 3 times." And he went outside and wept bitterly. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And they said many other insulting things to him. So what we've got here is Jesus is arrested and he's carried off to the high priest's house. And at that stage, we get the idea that there's confusion and most of the disciples have scattered, but Peter hasn't deserted Jesus at that stage. He follows at a distance to see what's happening. And he enters this sort of courtyard of the high priest's house, a sort of semi-public area where there's other people milling around. And he sort of can keep an eye on what's happening and see what's happening to Jesus. And we've read it in the story there. What ends up happening with Peter is that he denies knowing Jesus. He denies being associated with Jesus three times. Starts off with a servant girl just saying, "Oh, I think this is one of them." And he says he doesn't know him. And then someone else a little later and he says, "I'm not." And then an hour later, he's identified as a Galilean and he replies, "I don't know what you're talking about." And these denials seem to get more extreme. In some of the other books that recount this, by that last one, it says he's calling down curses on himself. I imagine him like the kids who I teach at school say, "Swear down on my mum's life, I never knew him." That sort of thing. It starts off as a denial and it gradually escalates. One denial leads to another. The first one makes the second one easier. And then once he's got into it, the second one, then he's going to deny it again. And he's ended up denying that he even knows Jesus. Now, this Peter was one of the disciples, but this isn't like, oh, the leader of the organization was let down by a lower level employee. This is a personal failure. Peter loved Jesus and Jesus loved Peter. He'd spent 3 years with him. He's been at his side during all the miracles and the teaching and the conflict. Peter was committed to Jesus. It was his best friend, but then he's let him down badly. He's failed him. And that's when you get, it says Jesus turned and looked at Peter. Presumably Jesus is in the house, his trial's about to start or whatever. Presumably he's able to look out and he catches Peter's eye. Just try and imagine like that scene there where Peter's just denied knowing Jesus for the third time and he just catches Jesus' eye and Jesus is looking at him. It's absolutely crushing. That one look from Jesus to Peter in the midst of his sin and Peter breaks down. It says he leaves and he just weeps bitterly. He's failed the person he loves the most. He's let Jesus down at his hour of greatest need. This is when Jesus really needed him. He's let him down and he's absolutely crushed by it. This is the same man who in verse 33, just earlier that evening before they went out from the Last Supper, Peter says, "Lord, I'm ready to go with you to prison and to death." I think Peter believed that. Yeah, he's committed. I'm willing to go, even if it means I'm going to get arrested, even if it means I'm going to die. I'm so committed to Jesus that I'm going to be with you. But then actually, when it came down to it and the pressure came on, he wasn't willing to risk prison or perhaps death. He was afraid and he denied even knowing Jesus. Now, I think if you're a Christian, you'll recognize this sort of experience. One of the commentators I read said, having the same kind of experiences, most of us can identify with Peter. Under the pressure of public opinion, because we want to fit in or get ahead, we sometimes say or do things that are unworthy of Christians. In the heat of the moment, we can act in a way that we thought we wouldn't and we wished we hadn't. And even as we're doing it, we're regretting it. I was just thinking about, I've worked at the same place for a very long time. And when I first started there, I don't find it particularly easy to sort of make friends. And so I was just trying my best to try and get to know people there and find it quite difficult, as I often do. And I remember once approaching two of the men who I used to work with and I sort of joining them partway through a conversation that they were having. And I just heard them sort of talking about somebody else saying, "Oh, he's a complete nutter, that bloke. He's a complete nutter." And so I'm thinking, oh, well, what better way is there to get into a group than to talk about how much of a nutter somebody else is? And so I just sort of like joined in the conversation. And then as it transpired, I don't know who it was they were talking about, but as it went on, it became clear why they thought he was a complete nutter, because they went on and explained. They said, "Oh, yeah, he's one of those Christians, you know, one of those Christians who believes that Jesus could actually do miracles. He believes that Jesus was actually the Son of God." Like, can you believe that? He actually believes that Jesus was the Son of God. This guy's a complete nutter. And as they're saying that, I'm thinking, oh, hang on here. I was trying to join in to say, yeah, this guy's a complete nutter. Look at how non-nutterish I am. But it turned out the guy that they were describing believed things that I also believed. And I just started thinking, oh, what are they going to say to me? Are they going to question me about it? Because I believe that Jesus did miracles. I believe that Jesus was the Son of God. What are they going to think of me? And the conversation never went that way. It went off onto something else. But I just remember that as an example of now, if I'm sitting there, or even if on that day, if I'd been sitting out of the situation, I would have said, yeah, I understand that some people will think that some of the things I believe are weird. They might even think I'm a nutter because of it. But that's fine. And I'm fine with that. And I can say that now. I could have probably said that then, but in the heat of the moment, it just feels different. It feels pressurized. It feels like the heat's on. And I don't know, I may well have denied Jesus at that time if they'd asked me. We fail in this sort of way when we fear other people, when we fear man. It's known as the fear of man. And it's summed up in the title of a book by a guy called Ed Welsh that says, we fail in this way when, his book's called, When People Are Big and God Is Small. We've given people such a massive place and a massive importance above God, and then we act in these sort of ways. He says this in that book. We fear people because they can expose and humiliate us. We fear people because they can reject, ridicule, or despise us. We fear people because they can attack, oppress, or threaten us. These three reasons have one thing in common. They see people as bigger, that is, more powerful and significant than God. And out of the fear that that creates in us, we give other people the power and right to tell us what to feel and think and do. And so here's Peter doing something that he never thought he'd do. He's letting Jesus down in his hour of greatest need because people became big, and that the fear of what might happen became big and God became small. So just have a think for yourself, like what is it for you? If you're a Christian, what is it for you? What is the fear there that could lead you to a situation like Peter here? Is it fear of being mocked by other people? Is it a fear that people might think they thought you were intelligent and now they'll think you're an idiot? Is it fear of somebody then confronting you with a barrage of questions and you don't have the answers? Is it fear of physical danger? Is it fear of loss of a relationship? Is it fear of being associated with like weird type of Christians that you don't want to be associated with? What is it? There'll be something for us. What are the circumstances that could cause you or that have caused you to deny your relationship with Jesus? I think it's important that when we think of that, that we own those things, don't bury them, don't pretend that they didn't happen or they don't exist, don't excuse them. We need to face them like Peter had to here. Like, we need to face Jesus looking at us and just be broken by our failure. Because there is good news coming, which will come shortly, but we've seen there people, Peter letting Jesus down, and then the next thing we see is people beating Jesus up. After Peter's denials, we see a group of guards beating Jesus up, mocking him, insulting him. Where Peter represents somebody who loved Jesus, who failed and let Jesus down and wished they hadn't done it, these men represent people who were openly hostile towards God. Peter let Jesus down. These guys are beating Jesus up. It's absolutely ridiculous to think of Jesus being mocked and beaten. It's like humans mocking and beating God. It says in the Bible that everything holds together by because of Jesus. Like the only reason why the cells in their body, as they slapped him and punched him, held together was because Jesus said they would. It's absolutely ridiculous scene to think of humans beating up God, but that's what he allows. He could have stopped that at any time, but he chose not to. It reminds me, and I tried to get the video working that I could play it on here, but it wouldn't work properly, of the scene in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where Aslan has decided to sacrifice himself, and he's walking up to the stone table towards the evil queen and all these evil characters around, and he's going to allow himself to die. And there's the scene in the film, I think, captures it absolutely brilliantly, that there's all these like creatures like shouting at him and grabbing at him, and they're cutting his mane off. Now, he could have turned around at any point, and with a roar, they would have scattered. There's even a hint in the film, it'd be like half does a snarl, and some of them like sort of startle and step back, and then they continue what they're doing. The only reason why that is happening is because he allowed it. And it's the same with Jesus here. The only reason why they can insult him, mock him, make fun of him, punch him, beat him up, the only reason why they can do any of that is because Jesus allows them to. One form that their mockery took, that we told there, is asking him to prophesy who'd hit him. So they're hitting him, or he can't say, like, who hit you then? Was it me? It's treating prophecy as if it's some sort of cheap party trick, like saying, oh, I'm thinking of a number, can you guess what it is? Prophecy is speaking the words of God, and Jesus was the prophet. He only spoke what the Father told him to. He was the word of God. He's the definition of what prophecy is. And they're slapping him around saying, oh, prophesy about this. If you're such a great prophet, tell us what's going on. The irony is that this incident, this beating itself, was prophesied hundreds of years earlier. In Isaiah chapter 50, Isaiah prophesies, and he sort of speaks as if he is the Messiah, the coming one of God, and says, I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting. And even just a few chapters earlier in Luke 18, it's verse 32, Jesus had told his disciples, he just predicted that he was going to die. And he says, he's referring to himself as the Son of Man. He says, the Son of Man will be handed over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, insult him, and spit on him. Like, they're mocking him. Oh, prophesy this. You can't see who's hitting you now. But this event was prophesied by Jesus himself, and it was prophesied hundreds of years earlier by Isaiah. Now, I think in our lives, we see this sort of mocking and insulting Jesus in the likes of sort of your militant atheists who are saying that the God of the Bible is evil. But we also see it in our own lives. We see it when we try to push God off the throne and climb onto that throne ourselves. You probably have heard me say that, like, one of the ways I often describe sin is that we want to grab all God's stuff and then we turn our back and we're walking away sticking two fingers up at it. That's the same thing here. There's a song I'm going to play at the end here that has these lyrics. I have long withstood his grace, long provoked him to his face. And I often think that about my life, especially before I was a Christian, that the way I was living and the arrogance that I had was like provoking Jesus to his face. He could have just clicked his fingers and wiped me out, but he didn't. So maybe you identify with one of these stories more than the other. Maybe you really identify with, like, letting Jesus down. You feel like you've let him down. Or maybe you identify more with the people who are openly hostile towards God. To be honest, I see myself in both of those stories, letting Jesus down and beating Jesus up. It's a pretty bleak sort of situation, except for the fact that we haven't considered what Jesus is doing during all of this, and that's where we're going to finish. While Peter is letting Jesus down and while people are beating Jesus up, the thing that Jesus is doing is he's allowing this to happen. This is a dark moment in the life of Jesus. He's been betrayed, he's been arrested, let down by his friend, beaten up, mocked, insulted. He's on his way to death. But it's only happening because he's choosing to let it happen. Like I said, he's like Aslan on that walk to the stone table. He could turn around and destroy all of these people, but he doesn't. As he's being punched by the soldiers, he's letting them punch him because it's part of his path to the cross, where he's going to die for sin. He's going to die for their sin. Jesus' death on the cross is going to make forgiveness available even to those people who are spitting in his face and mocking it. Jesus endures all of this in order to get to the cross. That's why he's putting up with it all. When it comes to Peter's denial, it didn't catch Jesus by surprise because he predicted it earlier in the evening. In verse 34, he says, I tell you, Peter, before the cock crows today, you will deny three times that you know me. Jesus wasn't surprised at what Peter did. And the good news is, he not only predicted that Peter would deny knowing Jesus, he also predicted that Peter would be restored in the future. A couple of verses earlier in verse 32, he says, I have prayed for you, Simon, that's Peter, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. It's not a question of if Peter recovers from this terrible failure of Jesus. Jesus predicted the failure and said, when you turn back, then strengthen everybody else. Peter's failure of Jesus is atoned for on the cross, and Jesus extends grace to Peter, and he extends the same grace to me and you. This is absolutely huge. This is really important to get your head round. Jesus knows when you are going to let him down. And when that happens, he is going to extend grace to you. Your failure last week didn't catch him by surprise. Your failure of him next week is not going to be the final one where now he's not going to extend grace to you anymore. You're not going to get beyond the limits of his grace. When you feel like, oh, I've let Jesus down, I've absolutely failed, I've done the same thing again. I denied him once, now I'm on the third time, I've done the same thing again. If anything, it's getting worse. Jesus is going to do the same as he did with Peter to you. He's going to extend grace to you. Just think back again to that look when it says that Jesus like turns around, just as Peter's at the worst point of his failure, Jesus turns around and catches his eye and looks at him. What sort of look is that? If that was me, I'd be trying to give like the look. So I've tried, I don't know how successful it is, but I've tried over the years of teaching to cultivate a look, whereas I'll look at a kid who I've just told to stop doing something and then started doing it again. Non-verbal reprimand or something we might say, but I'm trying to look at them and I'm trying to convey that I'm thoroughly disappointed with them. I'm frustrated with them. I'm angry. I want them to stop doing what they're doing. Otherwise there are going to be consequences. I'm trying to communicate all of that with a look. Now, in this sort of situation, if I was Jesus, that's the sort of look I would be given. But good news for all of us, I'm not Jesus. That's what Michael would do. That's not what Jesus did. Jesus is not looking with a look of frustration and anger and disappointment. He's looking with a look of love. It's the look of love, not frustration, not disappointment. That's how Jesus looks at you. Right? Even if you're right in the middle of your failure now, you feel like, oh, I've let Jesus down. Like, how could he? I can't bear for him to look at me. He's looking at you with love. He's extending grace to you. That's how Jesus operates. That's the Christian life. That's absolutely huge to get our heads around. The way we respond to failure often shows what we believe about grace. If we're beating ourselves up and think we never go back to Jesus, that shows that we're relying on our own performance. When we fail, we should be quick to run back to Jesus, quick to run back to the cross, because that's where we'll find all the grace that we need to cover our sin. So I'm pretty much finished there. Just want to say how we might respond to this for people in different categories. It might be that you're a Christian who you feel like you've let Jesus down, or maybe you feel like you've been beating him up. What I would say is lift your eyes up to his eyes again. Right? Be reminded of that look of love that he looks at you with. Your failure has been forgiven. You can feel free of that weight that you've been carrying. Maybe you're a non-Christian and you feel like your life has been mocking and insulting Jesus. And I just want to say to you that Jesus loves for you. He has love for you. He loves you. He died for your sin. He died for the mocking and insulting and the way you've provoked him to his face, the same as I have. You can receive that forgiveness now. And maybe you're a non-Christian just here watching this and you don't really identify with either groups. You're just sort of working out what you think about Jesus, and that's absolutely great. We love having all sorts of different people in Grace Church, and that's great. And what I would say is this is a good story for you to think about, because it highlights one of the greatest misunderstandings of what people think Christianity is about. It shows that Christianity is not about good people getting to go to heaven. Christianity is about people who fail, often failing deliberately, and a God of love who sacrifices himself on the behalf of those people. That's the message of Christianity.